Bill is looking for just about anybody who has legitimate biological evidence of a UFO abduction experience. And we'll have him give his address in just a moment. It's in Australia, but it's well worth it if you might have some proof. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Bill, before we go to calls, tell me about your quest to obtain physical, biological evidence.
Right. Well, obviously, my book here at the Alien gives a very detailed case study of one case. And there's another four cases that we briefly referred to as well that had varying sort of success or evidential value. But obviously, the main focus of the book is really to profile this story and this approach, this perspective, this whole, I guess, forensic take on or DNA paradigm approach to alien abduction stories, and with a view to try and apply science and the forensic approach to possible biological evidence. And because of that, I need to say that obviously we wouldn't be sort of taking a sample or a story at face value, really, because so much hangs on it in terms of the validity of the phenomenon. We would be trying to examine the stories, the experiences in as much detail, trying to establish a chain of evidence that validly connects the sample to the original claim or story, that kind of thing, and the full context of the story. Sure. So it's a fairly involved process, but one that I think is important because it offers the opportunity to put some sort of scientific perspective on it, and therefore we're not necessarily just based on subjective evidence or hypnosis or that kind of thing. We're dealing with possible solid evidence that might provide valid clues to what's really going on.
Now, you said earlier that you weren't as up on this being extraterrestrial as some of the other people. How come?
I just remain open-minded because, yes, it may represent a possible extraterrestrial sample, but the only way you could be certain with that is that if these findings were somehow validated by dozens of more similar sorts of samples, because really it's really an extraordinary claim to be able to prove that it's definitely extraterrestrial, because so much hangs on that single statement. And really, in order to prove that to the satisfaction of, I guess, the scientific community and skeptics and all sorts of people out there, you really need to be able to validate that with a large body of evidence. But here we've got one detailed case study to indicate what's possible, what may be involved, and therefore that's why I have that caution.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Welcome, and where are you?
I'm in Altadena, California.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Okay, hi. Well, great show, both of you. Amazing. I have a question regarding your opinions on the validity of scientific remote viewing as a research tool of alien abduction.
Yes, well, I think the remote viewing thing is sort of big on claims and evidence, but really it's really hasn't come up with sort of solid kind of proof that it's an actual working ability. Yes, there's a lot of interesting and compelling kind of information that's going on, a lot of debate, a lot of controversy associated with it. I actually have a fairly long, detailed sort of endnote on the whole remote viewing perspective in my book, but in there as a kind of an endnote or a footnote, because it comes up as a little important sort of side issue in the book.
Excellent. Okay, well, that clearly answers it. Well, thank you. Great show. Very fascinating.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Do you know of any governmental research going on now into the UFOs in Australia, or do they just kind of sweep it away?
Well, we've had a fairly active kind of a research project called the Disclosure Project. It's not related to Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project in the States, but it's an independent project is in conjunction with the Australian UFO Research Network, and it looked at the totality of the government involvement with the UFO subject, and it kind of complemented the work that I did back in 82 to 84. And what it showed is that there's still ongoing kind of flirtation with it, but officially They're saying that they're not interested or involved in the subject, but from the inquiries that I often get with, even from military personnel, there does still seem to be ongoing interest, but not something that's confirmable at an official public level.
Okay, next up, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, Bob from New Jersey.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing? George, I want to, with your guest, make a statement trying to arrive at the true nature of extraterrestrials. But for the probability of probably never getting on your program again, let me just mention one thing before that. And that's your exorcism tape from Britain there?
No, we don't have time for that.
Okay, let me go into the other one then.
Okay.
I just was going to tell you something very interesting you could do
nope,
with that.
Nope, I got a guest, and let's pay him the tribute.
Okay, here we go. Trying to arrive at who ETs really are, religious doctrine really does refer to any order of beings higher than us are indeed angels, whether fallen or not, right? You do have regard for the Marian apparitions. I've heard you talk about them in the past, Fatima, whatnot. In La Salette, France, in that sequence of apparitions, it does make direct passage to certain events that we see. And it goes like there will be astounding prodigies that take place in the air and on the ground. It also makes reference to abductions by saying they will have the power to transport people from one place to another. And that is the message of La Salette, France. Look into that if you get a chance. And as far as your guest is concerned, regarding what I said, what do you think?
Well, I know this. A lot of clues that sort of come to us from what are perceived in traditional sort of religious contexts, etc. But there actually is an important new book that's sort of just been translated into English called Heavenly Lights, The Apparitions of Fatima and the UFO Phenomenon. It's the work of two Portuguese historians and UFO researchers, and it takes the Fatima experiences and looks at it from the benefit of having access to the records of the day, the church records, and it kind of puts an interesting new perspective on what may have occurred there. So I'm open-minded as to what's involved there, but it's an area that one has to pursue with caution because a lot of people have a lot of sensitivities in terms of interpretations of things that might have a religious context.
Bill, are they preserving UFO history? I mean, is there a central funneling point in Australia where this material, these cases, keep going? Is the government continuing to do this, or who is?
Well, certainly the government's not actively doing it, but the Disclosure Project that I mentioned here in Australia is doing that with the official record and to a certain extent with the civilian record, but researchers like myself are heavily involved with this kind of keenness to preserve the historical record, be it of a civilian nature or an official nature, and I've interfaced with similar sorts of projects, for example, in America, such as Project 1947 and Project Sign, which is the Sign Historical Group that acts as an arm of the Project 1947. Both of those organisations are devoted to preserving UFO history, and I think this is really kind of important because the longer this phenomenon goes on, the more we should be paying attention to its history as well, because, El Santiano, the philosopher, sort of said, you know, if you don't know your history, you'll be condemned to reliving it. And I know the UFO phenomenon sort of suggests that we've been doing a lot of repeat pedaling on our bicycles as we go through this whole UFO subject. And if we know our history in a lot of detail, we can be better informed in terms of interpreting what's going on today.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. And where might you be?
Hi, George and Bill. Keith in Volcano, California.
Hey, Keith. Hi.
Hey, funny you were talking about telescopes on your commercial there. Back when Hale-Bopp was around, back in 97,
yeah,
my son and the neighbor's grandson and I went down to the old historic Observatory Hill, and we had the telescopes out, and we were watching it and everything, and then the moon came up, and we decided to pack in the telescopes, but we had binoculars. And just as we started loading the telescopes, an orange amber orb appeared on the horizon, real low. And I got my telescope aimed right at it, and it came just about maybe 10 degrees off, right towards us, about a 10-degree angle off axis. And it got really close over the field that we were observing across, and it shot true vertical straight up in the sky and disappeared over the Sierra Nevada mountains in less than a second. Absolutely phenomenal.
Wonder what it was.
Well, I know what it was, and I put 20 years in the Navy.
Yep.
Aviation, well-trained, and it wasn't anything in my book.
It was not a plane. Bill.
But what does Bill think about these?
And well, they're happening everywhere.
Well, certainly it's an international, worldwide phenomenon, and now that description you've given there certainly takes that orange light or orange object out of the category of a lot of the orange lights reports that we have here in Australia, and particularly in America, where things like Jiffy fire starters and hot air balloons are used. You know, an object that actually takes off at straight up at high speed and disappears in a second, it's very difficult to explain away as something prosaic or a hoax or something like that. It seems like it's all bona fide to the UFO description.
Okay, thanks for being on the program. Next up, east of the Rockies, your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
My name is James. I'm calling from New York, and I would like to ask your guest if he ever heard of the research of Dr. Thomas Townsend Brown in the field of anti-gravity research. That's where I feel most of this UFO stories come from. I mean, I'm very familiar I've become familiar with what he's done and what his accomplishments are, and I wonder if you or your guest can make any comment about this gentleman.
Now, what do you mean, though, that most of these UFO reports come from anti-gravity stories?
Well, Dr. Brown himself was an individual who was interested in UFOs, and what he discovered was, when he was a young man, that certain types of materials, I think one of them was bakelite, if you charged it with electricity, and you could get up to something like 300,000 volts, it would show a movement towards its positive pole.
Do you ever investigate the type of propulsion systems that are out there, Bill?
Well, it's something that we obviously look at as researchers. You know, the kind of clues that you have in UFO reports, particularly the bona fide ones, obviously, might give clues as to what kind of propulsion systems are going on. Townsend Brown's work is often used by people to argue that a lot of the UFO phenomena due to man-made kind of objects that are suppressed, etc., that kind of thing. But as the listeners mentioned there, he seemed, I guess, inspired to a certain extent by the UFO phenomenon that he was aware of. And as far as I'm aware, I believe Townsend Brown was one of the early members of NICAP, one of the early UFO groups in America back in the 1950s. So, maybe it is a way of understanding UFO propulsion, but it's such a complex phenomenon that it's very, very difficult to put a handle on it. But maybe it represents advanced technology, and by paying attention to UFO reports, we can get a better handle on it.
13 years since the Peter Corey case. He's now about 41, 42 years old. What is he doing? Do you keep in touch with him?
I'm in quite regular contact with Peter, and obviously, you know, I think it's courageous of Peter to be involved with helping put this story out. He's steadfastly stood by the story and has run the gauntlet, so to speak, from, I guess, my interrogations or interviews, and it's been totally intense, the research, etc., and he's put up with my intrusions, and the story, his experience and his credibility and the evidence, as far as I'm concerned, has stood up to that scrutiny and survived the gauntlet. And so we have Peter's story, as far as Hair of the Aliens concerned, out there for people to examine and consider.
And apparently the 1992 case was not his first case, was it?
No, he had an earlier experience, as I mentioned briefly earlier, in 1988, that seemed to take the classic form, I guess, of what people recognise as the typical grey alien encounter. But for him at that time, he had no real awareness of the UFO subject and no context to put this in. And having just sort of come from his native country was Lebanon, coming across as a child and then sort of growing up in the Australian community, when he first had this experience, he had no real reference point to understand it. And it was only months later that he was driving around with his future wife that he and his fiance observed large poster displays of Whitney Strieber's paperback edition of Communion, and it stunned him when he saw that poster of the alien face, because that's what he had encountered back in 1988. And yet the initial posters that he observed with his partner didn't give any clue as to what was it about. It was part of a sophisticated kind of advertising campaign to introduce the paperback edition of Whitney Strieber's book, and it took another week or two before they learnt that this was all about a book. And when finally his partner acquired the book, she kept telling him, "You've got to read this. You know, it's full of stuff that you're telling me. You've been telling me about that happened to you." And eventually, he did sort of look at the book, and he found plenty of similarities, but just as many dissimilarities as well. So for him, it was kind of a preliminary anchor point as to what might be going on.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Pat from Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Pat, welcome. Hi.
Thank you. And I had a question on how you can tell the difference between our stealth things and UFOs. I saw something, it's been a couple of years ago, but it was one of the triangular things.
Yes.
And I saw it like real close. I mean, if you hold your arms up, it was like covered, you know, as far as you could go and spread them out 3 feet. That's how big the thing was in the sky. But it was like an equilateral triangle, but all the corners were rounded. And on the bottom of it, it looked kind of like a bath mat. I mean, you know how you're looking at it, because it was evenly spaced and it had all these round things on it, but it didn't have a single light on it, and it didn't make any noise.
Well, one of the things we wonder about here, Bill, in this country, is whether people are seeing real UFOs or if they're seeing American technology. Or, in some cases, I'm wondering if you're looking at reversed engineered technology, where we've picked up ideas from saucers and craft and made these planes.
Well, I guess that all those possibilities could be what's going on. But when you have those objects or similar objects sort of landing, and out steps unusual creatures, etc., that don't appear to be human, or they're doing things that seem to go way beyond our abilities as, I guess, flesh and blood humans, etc., that kind of thing, really bizarre interactions and that kind of thing, that's when you start to appreciate more readily that we're dealing with a UFO phenomenon, something that seems to be totally alien to us. But when they're up in the sky, etc., and particularly in more recent years, the pace of advanced technology and defence developments, etc., it does make it more and more difficult to, I guess, reconcile what are we dealing with, particularly when in the area of triangular objects.
We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Friday into Saturday, open lines. It'll be spooky night, so get ready for that. But when we come back, we'll take final phone calls with our guest Bill Chalker and you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Bill Chalker, final segment. Bill, with the reports that you continue to investigate, do they still seem to be coming in at the same pace, or are they slowing down?
Well, I've always felt that there's a high sort of smoke-to-signal kind of ratio, noise-to-signal ratio kind of going on, there's always been a consistent core UFO phenomenon that's really difficult to explain and seems to be the bona fide UFO phenomenon when you get through it and investigate it thoroughly. That seems to be still consistent. What changes is that you get a lot of misidentified type of events, etc., and they're generally easy to fathom out. Now, obviously, genuine misidentifications of aircraft and astronomical objects, that kind of thing, those sort of things have a continual ebb and flow, and quite often that can correlate with media publicity or the latest sci-fi film coming out, that kind of thing. But the UFO phenomenon seems to be generally fairly consistent at a kind of a lower level.
You know, you talked about that one case where a UFO seemed to come out of a pond, and you talked about the reeds. Do you get many reports of underwater UFO sightings, and then people see it splash out of the ocean and just take off?
Well, yes, we do get the odd occasional reports of those. They're somewhat rare, but they're certainly interesting kinds of cases, and even the submarine type object that you often get, or unidentified submerged object, whatever, that seems to be capable of things that are beyond anything that we have going around underwater.
All right, let's go back to the phones. First time caller line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really appreciate that I can get through. I tried numerous times, but you remember recently you were talking about synchronicity and,
yes,
and the odds of things falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
I've had three, I almost fell off my chair, I've had three come up just on the last three calls, which all correlate to what your guest from Down Under is talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
And this is absolutely amazing. But one night, I don't know if it was Art or yourself on the air, some fellows called in that had seen one of these black triangular things, much the same as what your lady, your former caller, was talking
mm-hmm.
about. No sound, the rounded corners, huge, enormous. Came right over their fishing boat with no sound, like a great horned owl, you know, just silent. And that night they had called in. I was walking my hound dog in a wooded area next to a military base, and I saw some creatures that I hope never to see again.
What did they look like?
I'm afraid to even describe them. They were like half humanoid, half robotic. I could see two of them. Actually, my dog spotted them when he ran down a ravine. Have you ever seen a hound dog backtrack slowly?
I remember one of my labs did that a long time.
Yeah, well,
he
knew something was there that could eat him up. Anyway, these things, I know what I saw. I heard them. They were communicating with each other inside the military base with a liquid sound, like the old, you know, the Meborp and all this stuff. It was like it was coming through liquid with little light luminescence. I thought, I ain't sticking around for this. But what was strange is when we hiked up the hill, this is right across the bay from where these fishermen had called in and saw the black object go over. A small dog was barking at them further up, and it barked, and then it ceased to bark forever. In fact, that whole neighborhood, I haven't seen any sign of life all along that fence line since that night.
I wonder if you've shared that story with some of the local UFO research groups.
I did call in because they have these terror watch things. I did call into the military base to alert them that there was, you know, they say to be vigilant, and they kind of acted like maybe I shouldn't be talking about it.
Like, well, what about we're communicating with a civilian group, perhaps one of the civilian research
groups? Yeah, I'd like to. Anyway, what's strange is that that night, further up the coast, where these other fishermen, we had a 43-foot fishing boat totally disappeared. No trace of it's ever been found, and its crew.
What was the weather like then?
Pretty calm.
Mm.
And we've had several, over the last few years in Central California, we've had several fishing vessels totally disappear. And what's strange is they have the satellite communication thing for locating. And in each case, they've only had one blip on the thing and then nothing, which is almost impossible. These things are supposed to send off even in a deep sea canyon like we have here in the bay. And in each case, there's one blip and then one life jacket, no trace of the boat or the crew.
You know, Bill, these could be frightening cases where you have these abductions occurring. You know, it's bad enough to be tested on and then they leave you and then they go. but to be taken from this planet, like the case you were talking about of the pilot and huge ships being taken and things like that, it makes you wonder what they're doing with this.
Well, it certainly conjures up all sorts of sort of strange, bizarre possibilities, and some of, obviously, as you say, are frightening possibilities as well. But I guess really what we need to do here is to be as armed with as much sort of verified information as we can to really understand what's truly going on, because there's a big difference between a sort of anecdotal story, but if you're dealing with something that's been documented in a lot of detail, et cetera, then we get the kind of true measure of what's going on. And when we have collectively a lot of those sorts of well-documented experiences, we can approach this with much greater certainty. It's really about being better informed and to get an understanding of what's truly going on.
David Jacobs writes that these visitations aren't as benevolent as most people would think.
Well, a lot of people have conflicting viewpoints about it, and I'm open-minded to this. You know, I've sort of had cross-sections of that whole kind of broad spectrum of perceptions about the nature of it, whether it's positive or whether it's negative or hostile, friendly, that kind of thing. And so I'm kind of open-minded, and really it comes back to, I guess, trying to scrutinize these cases as carefully as we can and to get a better understanding of what the reality is all about.
Pick up by going east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program. Where are you calling from?
Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, it's all yours.
All right, two questions for you. One, you're from Australia. Are you an AC/DC fan?
Of course. We all are here.
right on. Good to hear. All right, my question is, back in the early 1990s, there was footage taken from a space shuttle. To be a UFO being shot at, and the shot came from near Australia, near Ayers Rock. You ever heard about any kind of secret installation or whatnot over there in the desert near Ayers Rock?
Well, of course, that case of the shuttle footage, et cetera, it's pretty controversial. And yes, people have suggested that there seems to be evidence on the footage that there was some sort of light beam or firing, et cetera, that came from the centre of Australia, et cetera. And I guess the only facility we have there of any consequence is the Pine Gap facility, and it has all sorts of apocryphal stories connected to it. And in terms of what we've been able to verify, it's really obviously a sensitive American base that is shared with the Australians, etc. But it remains to be seen as to what's truly going on there.
You don't really have any idea what they might be doing there?
Well, what I'm saying, or what I'm trying to say here, is that there are a lot of claims made, but those sort of more striking stories of suggestions of underground bases there and an alien connection or whatever, these are virtually impossible to verify. They're just really extraordinary stories, etc., but usually not. We're not able to verify them, but it's certainly a source of a lot of rumours, a lot of claims, and a lot of extraordinary tales, that kind of thing. So we just try to investigate them. We have researchers there that are affiliated with the Australian UFO Research Network based in that kind of area that sort of try to document cases in that area, and it does seem to be a bit of a hotspot for UFO reports.
Okay, great. Thanks for your phone call. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, Bill. Hi, George. It's Jim in Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Jim. Hey,
Bill, how do you spell your last name?
Chalker, Chalker.
Okay. I can remember that. I was wondering in your investigations if it's, people who believe in UFOs are more likely to see them than someone who doesn't. I mean, it's almost a necessity to, you got to believe it before you see it. And then also...
I don't really agree with that statement, because there's plenty of skeptically inclined people that have had UFO encounters as well. And so that's kind of a bit of a folklore to UFO sightings, that it's entirely represented by true believers, et cetera.
I didn't mean it that way, but I wanted to get your take on it. Almost the paranormal stuff, I mean, like out of Star Wars, you got to believe it before you can do it or something or see it. And then I was wondering if people of, if certain ethnicity, sorry, like Irish and Native Americans, are more likely to see it than to have an encounter or something like that than than not. You know, I mean,
well, I think if anything comes out of this evening's program, it's the fact that this is a worldwide UFO phenomenon. Therefore, there are people from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds that have had these encounters: China, Africa, South America, Australia, United States, all through Europe. Sightings come from everywhere, and all sorts of people report them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was wondering if, are they more likely to occur in stressful situations, where somebody's in danger or something like that, and then, maybe he or a relative will see one of those things? Right? From family experience here.
Right. Like a crisis apparition type thing, you mean, or some sort of connection between family members observing something?
Well, I'll put it, 30 years ago, my aunt was lost snowmobiling in southwest Montana. It was 25, 30 below zero Fahrenheit. And they came across a prospector's old cabin, a ramshackle thing, not much left of it. She and her friend built a fire, stayed warm, as they could. They got through the night. They survived. And my uncle, on the way out, somebody saw the fire, and the rescue was made on the way out. He saw one. And he's a believable guy. Personally, I don't want to believe in him, and I've got a little cognitive dissonance. I mean, I'd rather believe they don't exist, but hey, my uncle saw one, and he's a pretty credible guy.
People have seen them under the least likely circumstances, stressful circumstances, and obviously under circumstances where people haven't been stressed, etc. It happens at all sorts of different times.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reptilians. Have you ever come across any of your research?
Well, that's pretty much a very bizarre kind of take. But believe it or not, I've got a couple of little detail footnotes in the book about that as well. But it's sort of a pretty difficult area to sort of cover in sort of brief detail.
But you do believe they're visiting us?
Well, I certainly accept that people are reporting these sorts of stories. But it's kind of almost like an atavistic take on, our kind of connections with the past and the animal world and that kind of stuff, but it's certainly something that pops up in a lot of the shaman type accounts and in some of these shaman cases. I treat one in detail in my book, the experiences of Credo Matwa, Zulu shaman in Africa, who has sort of those kinds of takes on the UFO phenomenon.
Next up, Wildcard Line, your turn. Where are you?
Hi, I'm Mark, Winnipeg, Canada.
Hi, Mark, go ahead.
Great show, George. I got a quick question for you, kind of touching on what the last caller asked. I was wondering, of all the cases that you have investigated that have seemed a little bit more credible, where people have had close encounters with extraterrestrials, have you noticed any, obviously there's different ethnicity differences and stuff, but have you noticed any similarities? Is there anything that these extraterrestrials are looking for? Is there a rhyme or reason? Because I know many people that haven't seen them. I mean, George, you admitted to yourself that you haven't had an encounter.
No,
so
that's right.
People that have really good experiences that you've investigated, what are they looking for? Is there like a rhyme or reason why they pick some people? Or?
There's sort of suggestive things, but really when it comes down to hard documented sort of correlations, there aren't really correlations that you could hang your hat on, because if we knew those correlations, we'd be sort of monitoring those situations very, very carefully, and that would allow us to kind of predict the occurrences of these things, but yet we don't have that kind of certainty.
Okay, thanks for your call. A few more minutes left. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Hi, George. This is Sue. I'm calling from Indiana.
Hi, Sue. Go ahead. We've got a couple minutes left.
Okay. I just wondered from your guest if he's ever heard of any alien-type entities communicating with each other, kind of like the one of the last callers talked about, in some kind of language that sounds similar to water or dribbling water.
There are accounts that we've had in Australia like that, but they're... is a great variety of things that are reported. Yes, we have had sort of situations like that, but other sorts of cases as well.
That gives me the creeps, because I've heard something like that, and I thought for sure that it was entities speaking. But whatever these entities were completely invisible to the human eye at the time. And it bothers me very much that this came up, because I thought I was, like, maybe crazy, I don't know. And so this is the first time that I've ever heard any ufologists of any kind or alien-type people that are talking about this stuff bring up that subject of what the language, their languages might sound like. And,
well, I think it really boils down to people like yourself and others that have had these sort of experiences that they should sort of get in contact with groups like civilian groups that are well represented in America and around the world. And if we know about these things, we can better understand what is going on. And obviously, that's the kind of information that we need.
This is very unusual. This happened in New Hampshire on my sister's property. And it was late at night and stuff. And I thought maybe the neighbors left water running, but apparently not. It's quite frightening. But thank you.
Okay, thank you. She sounds upset, and it does affect people sometimes that way, I guess, huh?
Well, that's clearly the case. Sometimes these experiences are a major confrontation. Like, for example, with Peter Curry's experience in my book, Hair of the Alien, the first chapter is called Shattered World. You know, his first major experience back in 88 was really shattering his kind of worldview. It was really a real major confrontation and really sort of turned his whole world perception upside down.
Fascinating.
Quite a major impact on him.
There is a graphic picture of him on a table from that 1988 encounter, and he doesn't look too happy. They're sticking some kind of needle in his head.
Yes, yes. That was a pretty shattering experience for him and really extraordinarily frightening for him.
And then, of course, is the picture of the blonde woman and the Asian who were in his room in 1992. Fascinating.
That obviously had a different impact on him, and at least it provided some sort of impressive evidence for us to look at to really try and get a handle on what's going on here.
Absolutely. Bill, thanks for spending the time with us. If I ever get to Australia, I'll look you up.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Nikki Imbrononi, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.